The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of September 2020 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Monocle's newsroom here in Zurich. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's program, Japan's ruling party has chosen Yoshihide Suga as the successor to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. We'll be getting the latest from our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson. Then, while protests continue in Minsk, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko flies to Sochi to seek support from Russia's Vladimir Putin. We'll also be hearing from the mayor of Athens, Kostas Bakoyannis.
Athens, as we speak, is a prime location. Athens has, because of the crisis, the prices actually have fallen over the past few years. So now there is a great window of opportunity for someone to come and invest in the city.
More from Mayor Bakoyannis a little bit later. All that plus the week's culture news right here on The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé. Good afternoon from a very sunny Zurich. We begin today's program in Japan, where the country's governing party has elected Yoshihide Suga as its new leader. He's now expected to become the country's next prime minister. Of course, succeeding Shinzo Abe. Well, to get right into this, we are joined on the line from Tokyo by our bureau chief, Fiona Wilson. Good afternoon or good evening, Fiona.
Good evening.
Not much of a surprise, of course. This has been tipped for a while. We've touched on, of course, certainly the career already, and I guess the standing of Yoshihide Suga. But I guess for those who might have missed it, I guess we can probably say this is a very safe set of hands, but probably not the most dynamic mitts at the wheel.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair description, Tyler. I mean, you know, everyone knows about Suga. He has been with Abe since 2012 as cabinet office spokesperson. So he's really been there every step of the way. He's had to deal with every scandal, every policy, unpopular bit of legislation. He's been the person who's either batted away, answered questions, tricky questions from journalists. So he does really understand how Abe's administration has worked. And he said, you know, I'm going to pretty much carry on as before. I mean, he's not really known as a personality, although he's been very present. People didn't really know much about him. You know, he's had a bit of a brand makeover in the last week. Not always that's, you know, successful, I have to be honest. You know, they've had him in jacketless, in an open neck shirt, I think, to make him look a bit more approachable. Pictures of him eating a pancake, you know, to sort of make him seem like one of the people. But I think one of the things about him is that, you know, interestingly, he is not from one of these big political families. And that does make him interesting. He's not like Shinzo Abe. He doesn't come from a dynasty, you know, with all these sort of famous politicians in his background. Son of a farmer, worked his way through university, worked in a cardboard factory, shifted vegetables at Tsukiji. You know, he's done the hard work. And I think that a lot of people feel that he does connect with issues that affect voters. Even if he doesn't necessarily connect with voters themselves, he understands the issues that bother people. And a lot of people say that, unlike Shinzo Abe, who's, you know, very much driven by a certain kind of ideology, that Suga is a bit more of a realist. He's a pragmatist. He knows what matters to people. So he's been talking about some changes. He is definitely a safe pair of hands, but he's been making a few quite interesting noises about reducing mobile phone bills, for example. He wants to reorganise the bureaucracy. He's been talking about these silos, ministries not talking to each other. There are a few signs of something quite interesting, reorganising regional banks that are struggling with depopulation. And that's one of the big issues for him, is this rural economy. So there are a few, glimmers of some quite interesting, potentially some quite interesting parts of his policies.
And when you think of those policies, Fiona, are those things that they simply were not of importance to Abe? Because one would have assumed, obviously, just, given Suga's background and, of course, his proximity to Abe, he would have had considerable influence anyway to, of course, push forward some of his own ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, Shinzo Abe knew these issues were important, and he certainly... there were measures taken. I think if you look at the way the administration worked, actually Suga was quite important in, the go-to travel campaign. That was Suga really pushing that, getting people to go out into the regions. Now, the timing was terrible because it was just at a moment when people thought, no, we do not want people going into the regions. Thank you very much. We've got a virus to deal with. He also had this sort of hometown tax system that he set up, which was where people can opt to, instead of paying tax to the city, you can opt to have it funneled into rural communities. That's an option. So he's been dealing with that for quite a long time. And, you have to assume that it's partly because he comes from Yuzawa, this town in Akita in northern Japan, which has all the issues that rural Japan is facing. So I think, I think he does understand the problems that real Japanese people are facing.
I want to come back to your point about makeovers and whether any of it was sort of Shiseido fueled when we look at the new public face of Suga. How is he in a press conference? Do we have a sense of how he's going to also just behave in Parliament when faced with questions? And I'm getting to the topic of potential dynamism.
Yeah. To be honest, dynamism is not exactly in huge quantities. I mean, we've seen him. He's been at press conferences twice a day for nearly 8 years, these daily briefings he does. I think you could describe him as a little bit charmless. I think someone described him as having the charm of a praying mantis, which I'm assuming is not a good thing. He doesn't really smile a lot. He seems quite serious. And when he does smile, you feel it's not coming from the heart exactly. He feels like he ought to smile. They've tried to sort of reframe him as Uncle Reiwa, because he was the one who unveiled the new era when the emperor was enthroned. I don't think people are looking to him for a sort of cozy, cuddly prime minister. He just doesn't fit that mold. He may turn out to be quite different. He's not been in the spotlight. And, a few months ago, when I heard people talking about Suga as a possible replacement for Abe, and we thought, really? He just didn't seem that ambitious. And, it turned out he was nursing a very serious ambition to go to the top. So I think there's quite a lot we don't know about Suga personally yet, which may unfold.
Uncle Reiwa, not so catchy. I wonder, is there scope for him to, of course, benefit maybe from some more positive wins? And we don't need to talk about the Olympics, because, it seems that between Tokyo and Lausanne, it's going ahead no matter what. So that we can tick that box. But we saw some news probably over the last 48 hours that Singapore and Japan are going to open up a travel corridor now, which, of course... fantastic that this is happening. And perhaps if we see, of course, then maybe is Taiwan next and Hong Kong comes up, etc., as Japan does open up to the rest of the world for trade and tourism again, this will obviously, even though, he's new to the watch, he'll probably be the one who gets credit for it if things, of course, go in the right direction. But I'm just wondering, on that note about the Singapore-Japan corridor, how has that been met? I'm sure Japan Incorporated is excited, but again, is the average Japanese man or woman, Mr. and Mrs. Watanabe, are they excited about this, or at least positive about the fact that the country is opening up?
Yeah, I mean, I think, when you look at this, it's very specific. This is the new corridor opening between Japan and Singapore from the 18th. It's strictly for business travel, so not opening up to tourists yet. But what it is it's business travel without the need for quarantine, which is a big deal. That's the first time that's happened. There has been some places in Southeast Asia are open for expat, long-term residents have been able to travel to and from, which is a new one. That's only just happened. Places like Cambodia, Laos, Malaysia. And I think the difference is we're now talking about business, no need to quarantine. I think that's going to be the big change. I don't know about Suga taking credit. It was quite interesting when he won the vote today. He made his initial speech with Shinzo Abe sitting right behind him. And he was very careful to say he was, you know, when it came to COVID policies, he was building on what Shinzo Abe had laid out. So he's, you know, he's saying he's just going to do exactly what Shinzo Abe has said will happen between now and winter. And, you know, but I think it is, of course, it's a positive sign for business that it's starting to open up. And they've also been saying, you know, they're looking ahead to easing restrictions with China, South Korea, New Zealand and Australia are mentioned too. But obviously, you know, every country has got its own very specific issues. But no, I think it's being received positively.
Well, Fiona, I'm hoping that they open up Switzerland and Japan very soon as well. The lake is still warm enough and waiting for you.
I can't wait.
Our Fiona Wilson in Tokyo. It's just gone 13:09 here in Zurich. Time to head back to London. Yulene Goffin is there with the day's headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. The highest daily rise in global coronavirus cases has been recorded by the World Health Organization. Almost 310,000 cases were reported over 24 hours. The biggest increases in infections were reported in India, the US and Brazil. Worldwide, there have been more than 28 million confirmed cases, half of which have been in the Americas. A new national lockdown is to be imposed in Israel, starting from Jewish New Year on Friday. It will last 3 weeks. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the measures would exact a heavy price on us all, but the country faced a surge with 4,000 new daily infections. And David Cameron has become the third former Conservative Prime Minister in the UK to express disquiet about Boris Johnson's proposal to breach international law by unilaterally redrafting part of the Brexit deal with the EU. Cameron says he has misgivings about the idea. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Tyler.
Thanks very much, Yulene. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has arrived in Russia for talks with Vladimir Putin. It will be their first face-to-face meeting since protests broke out in Belarus last month following the disputed presidential election. Alex Kokcharov is a Russia and Eastern Europe analyst at the think tank IHS Market, and he's also a Belarusian himself. He joins us on the line. Good day.
Hello, good afternoon.
Is this much of a surprise? Has it come a little bit late? Of course, it's probably wonderful to go to Sochi at this time of year. But are you surprised that Lukashenko is shuttling down at this point?
Not at all. I think Lukashenko was indicating from the very beginning of the protest that he was seeking support from Russia in case if this protest become really challenging to his continued rule over Belarus. So it was only a matter of time before he would actually meet with Putin and discuss how Russia will be helping him and what Russia would be expecting in return.
And based on that, what do you think some type of meeting of minds would look like in terms of, you know, what would Russia want out of this? Of course, Russia has its own issues, and I'm sure many people are busy enough just dealing with relations in Berlin and, of course, Brussels at the moment. But if you think about a meeting between the two men, what would be top of the agenda?
Well, you know, for Lukashenko, there are two big items here. First, he needs assurances that Russia would actually provide security assistance to him in case if protests in Belarus become potentially violent and if the Belarusian police would not be able to contain the protests in case if they become violent. Secondly, Belarus urgently requires financial assistance. It needs significant amounts of money to pay its to meet its debt repayment obligations scheduled for the rest of the year, and the government would need financial assistance, which is probably going to be Russia because nobody else would be willing to provide this assistance. But from the Russian perspective, Russia will want much more from this. It may start with pretty symbolic things such as Belarusian recognition of Russian sovereignty over Crimea, but it can actually go much further, including bilateral integration between Russia and Belarus, but also issues such as Belarus giving some of the key industrial assets to Russian businesses, and also the issue of Russian military bases in Belarus is likely to be discussed as well.
Alex, how likely is it if things spiral out of control? We seem to be in a bit of a plateauy moment. But if things, of course, become a little bit more spicy in Minsk and elsewhere, would we really see? And I imagine it would be paramilitaries. We wouldn't be talking about tanks coming across the border. But would Putin be there very willingly with support? And of course, how would Brussels respond to this?
I think it's, we've seen that Belarusian protests have been largely peaceful and the only violence we witnessed came from the police. But there is a potential that police violence may radicalize some of the protesters. And we've seen calls for forming self-defense units amongst the protesters. If something like that happens and we're going to see we're going to see more assertive protesters, that might change the equation. And in this case, I think Russia would not be unlikely, obviously, to send tanks into Belarus, but to provide assistance in the form of the National Guard, which are Russian riot police, which would be deployed alongside with the Belarusian riot police to keep these protests in check. And I think that would be a more likely scenario.
Yeah, and if you're, of course, a leader or certainly someone sitting at the top of the food chain with NATO in Brussels, what type of response do you think will come? Is this, people will see this as par for the course that this would happen, or would this be seen as at least somewhat provocative?
I think it will obviously increase likelihood of action by the European Union and individual member states against both Belarus and Russia if something like that happens. But we have to remember that introduction of such EU-wide sanctions is not guaranteed. There have been media reports last week that Cyprus and Greece were blocking introduction of sanctions against Belarusian leadership because they want the EU to deal with Turkey. And we have seen that some of the immediate neighborhood EU member states, Baltic states and Poland, are actually leading the way on the personal targeted sanctions, such as travel bans against Belarusian leadership. But the EU-wide sanctions are not guaranteed, though any police violence in Minsk, any deployments of Russian forces to Belarus would increase the number of calls for such actions to be taken.
Alex Kokhturov, East Europe and Russia expert there. Thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. We've just gone 13:17 here in Zurich. You're with me, Tyler Brulai. Well, let's get a little bit of a roundup on what's happening in the world of culture this week. I'm joined from London by our culture editor, Chiara Rimella. Buongiorno.
Buongiorno and good afternoon to you, Tyler.
Good afternoon. Maybe we want to start off, you've got a variety of things, and maybe just given we've come off the back of an art fair weekend here in Zurich, Chiara, and of course we've got a number of other art weeks and weekends coming up. Why don't we venture into that world?
Interestingly, Tyler, I think it's a very strange time for art fairs this season because, as we know, the major events have been largely cancelled. We're talking, the Art Basels, the Friezes, and naturally Art Basel Miami Beach as well. But it's interesting to see how the art fair kind of calendar is shifting because much more localised events are taking place. We've reported on the Monocle Minute, for example, on the Berlin Art Week, but also we know of events such as Chart Art Fair that have gone on in their physical formats. Art Paris has gone on in its physical format, but the future of larger events is kind of still being discussed and in many ways still, threatened, even into next year. We started at the beginning of this year thinking that the autumn would be a bit of a moment of resurgence for these events. And now for the larger art fair, it's looking like even next spring might be a bit of a challenge. For now, Art Basel Hong Kong is still planning to go ahead as planned, but we have news that that Taipei Dang Dai has been moved from January to May and that Melbourne Art Fair has been moved from February to 2022. And there are question marks as to whether Freeze LA, which would be going ahead in February, will indeed go ahead. I think what's interesting is that many of the questions around these events have got to do with travel corridors and how likely travel is going to be. Because as we've seen with these more localized events, people are trying to find ways to go ahead with events in local places, putting restrictions in place and putting precautions in place. But the issue of shipping artworks, the issue of getting artworks and galleries to show in fairs further away from their patch is what's still really, really challenging.
Mm. Do you think there's almost a situation here, and it's not just the art world, but the art world, of course, has been impacted by maybe some of the dark forces of cancel culture on one side. We now have a new type of cancel culture, which is, as you've just highlighted, that we have these events being cancelled, you know, and then kicked out into the future. I'm wondering, is there a point, though, where things just have to go ahead? These things need to be reinstated. We expect that a biennale is going to start on this date, and it can't just sort of keep drifting out. And so I'm wondering, and even if, you know, and again, even if only 3,000 come versus 30,000, at least it reestablishes itself as a brand, because it strikes me that there is a real danger that there could also just be an erosion. If some of these things are missing from the calendar a few times, then also the participants are thinking, you know, do I really need to go anymore?
It's interesting you say that, because on the one hand, you could argue that when so many people were talking about art fair fatigue and not really wanting to go to that many art fairs, once you take them away from them, I think in the first half of the year, people really started feeling starkly that they missed art fair when they couldn't go anymore. And suddenly all their complaining about having to go to too many didn't feel quite that relevant anymore. But as you say, you know, if you then start removing this appointment altogether from the calendar for a year or more, then the dynamics starts to shift, and then galleries kind of find their own space without necessarily needing the middleman in the middle anymore. And you're, as you say, at risk of these art fairs essentially losing their relevance. So it's a tricky balance to strike, whether, you know, from a branding point of view, going ahead or not going ahead is the best option in the long run.
Mm. Let's turn our attention to the BBC. There's been a number of high-profile announcements. Of course, the BBC has a new director general coming in. But at the same time, we've seen a number of quite high-profile radio presenters, television presenters, who are going to be replaced. And obviously, they're looking for new blood to come in. And we've now just, of course, heard as well that there's something interesting happening also in the world of radio news at the same time.
Indeed, this is a report that's come out on The Observer here in the UK over the weekend, claiming that the BBC plans to ask its audio reporters to, I guess, reapply and change their position into more kind of cross-media reporters, so to work for TV, radio, as well as being digital reporters at the same time as well. And the concern, I guess, is that you lose a bit of the authenticity and the intimacy as well of just having people who are dedicated radio reporters. A certain level of cross-media ability is sometimes to be welcomed. You know, we do it here at Monocle. But I think at a time when people have rediscovered the importance of radio and the intimacy of recognizing these voices who have accompanied them sometimes for months on end, it's a strange thing to choose to do, to, I guess, cut back on the importance of radio and instead redirect somewhere else.
And you have to sort of wonder, of course, there's been a lot of pressure on the BBC around, you know, issues of diversity. And of course, we've talked about this, you know, over the years. There's the there's the visible component to it. But I've always also said about audio, it's like I'm always sort of missing, you know, for a service which, of course, yeah, speaking to people around the world, I've always said, you know, where is the Italian presenter on the BBC? You know, there's many elements of this missing. Of course, there's been this embrace of regional accents, of course, from throughout the UK on one side. But sometimes when you listen, you're sort of wondering, you know, where is the Greek accent? You know, where is the Finn? And of course, I'm very happy to say, of course, we have all of those here at Monocle 24. But is... what's your view, Chiara? I mean, do you think that in a modern world that someone can be great at filing digital copy on one side, then they can pop up on television, and then they're able to go and voice a good piece for radio? Because you've been, you know, you're doing a bit of that yourself, as you said, certainly working for our service.
I think so long as we maintain the ability to have that intimacy on radio and to not dilute our ability, but to also still put the same amount of effort into producing audio for radio that feels like it's meant to be for radio, then it can work. My worry with this is that if you produce the same report to air, both on radio and then on TV and then on digital, it doesn't work because you're just applying the same content to different media, right? Whilst if you can, you be the person who changes according to the media, it can work. And I hope that's what we try to do here.
I hope so too. I think we're doing reasonably well. Our Chiara Rommel, our culture editor in London, thanks very much for that. 1324, sorry, here in Zurich. When we come back, we'll be talking to the mayor of Athens. And now to the Eastern Mediterranean. After years of a deep economic crisis, the city is rising up, and with young Athenians and some investment returning, it's starting to have its moment. On this week's Chiefs, I sat down with the mayor of the Greek capital, Mr. Kostas Bakoyannis, to talk to him about his plans to improve the city's livability and how he aims to keep Athens in the spotlight. We started by talking about why now is the time to invest in the city.
Athens, as we speak, is a prime location. Athens has, because of the crisis, the prices actually, the values have fallen over the past few years. So now there is a great window of opportunity for someone to come and invest in the city. And especially since the city is actually transforming itself. Let me give you an example. I don't know whether you're familiar with Omonia Square. It's actually our second biggest square. We actually made the big change in the square itself, creating a new fountain and changing the landscape 100%. And this is connected with over 20 new investments in tourism, with over 20 new hotels that are built around this square. So it's only a matter of time until Athens changes.
You mentioned a series of projects that are underway. If I was to go and speak to the average Athenian, if there is an average Athenian, what would they say is missing in terms of quality of life right now? And what would you like to add? I mean, obviously, you know, you arrived with a powerful platform and mandate on one side. But you know, what are some of the key things when we think about good urbanism? When you think about what really improves people's daily routines, What needs to be delivered? And maybe it's also good to hear also what doesn't need to be fixed, because as we know, many cities, of course, got things right centuries ago. And I'm sure probably some of that comes into play when we speak of Athens as well.
This conversation has two levels. The first level is what we call back to basics, which is making sure that the city is clean, green, well-lit, safe and secure, which has to do with the daily lives and the quality of lives of our citizens. The second level has to do with reclaiming public space and liberating public space. And this is where the pandemic is both a crisis and an opportunity. As I'm sure you know, public health has been a catalyst for big changes in the past. The Central Park in New York or the London sewage system were actually created during public health crisis. And we are doing something similar as we speak. We have adopted the policy or the model or the methodology of tactical urbanism. We've been reclaiming public space, especially in the city center, unifying our archaeological sites and our cultural sites. We are trying to get to a new balance of sustainable transportation. This is not, of course, an easy task, but over the past few months, there's been a big improvement. I would say that Athens is, as we speak, in the process of actually reintroducing itself, both to its citizens and to its visitors.
If you venture out into a nice neighborhood where, of course, and I think good neighborhoods always have a pleasant mix of residents, and you've got businesses and street life below, is there a certain tension at the moment? Because if you look at a lot of European cities, particularly a lot of cities which have done well, those cities which always come at the top level ranks of quality of life, there's often you could say, almost a spoilt resident who wants a silent city. In fact, they've got everything they want. The trams run on time. There's plenty of space for bicycles. And so then that citizen starts to look for any other irritant as well, which they want to bring up, which they take up with politicians. What's your sense in Athens right now? Is there a way to go? And would you say, I wouldn't say citizens are spoiled, but I'm interested in that tension between trying to run a business and then also trying to run a city where people also feel that they're getting the best when it comes to livability.
Well, I mean, you know, these tensions exist all over the world and they exist in Athens as well. I think that there's one big difference when it comes to the character, the identity of Athens itself, which has to do with the fact that, you know, Greeks, by definition, are outward and social people. The climate, the way of life leads us to, you know, to actually enjoy life in our public spaces. I don't think that any Athenian can imagine the city closing at 10 or even at 11 or at 12. At the same time, though, this conversation opens the door to another key challenge that we face, which has to do with the distance between the so-called good and the so-called bad neighborhoods. Of course, urban centers all over the world tend to be centers or epicenters of socioeconomic differences. But these divides we aim to bridge. At the end of the day, it's about making sure that there aren't visible differences, there aren't such big differences. And that is our goal, that is our aim, to be able to actually secure social cohesion in the face of growing challenges that may have to do with the climate crisis, that may have to do with the influx of refugees and immigrants, growing challenges that may have to do with unemployment or the economical situation.
That was Kostas Bakoyannis, the mayor of Athens, and he'll be joining me for this week's edition of The Chiefs. You can catch the full episode of the program at 1300 London time tomorrow. I'm also very happy to say that Mr. Bakoyannis will be leaving his Mediterranean metropolis for some Alpine air and joining us at Monocle's first live in-person event, the Monocle's Chiefs Conference, later this week. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 for updates from, of course, our conference up in St. Moritz. And I'm also happy to say that I'm also joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck, who's fresh from London, but almost fresh from Athens as well.
Yes, I was just there a couple of weeks ago and will be really interested to see what the mayor has to say, because we know so many negative things that happened to the city in recent years. And actually, when I went, I was really struck by how vibrant and how exciting it was to be there. So great to hear him talking about how he's navigated his city to this position.
He was talking at the start of this, and I can't really tell from this side of the desk, Andrew, if you've got a sore neck or not, but were you looking up at bountiful, blooming terraces and thinking, Athens maybe wouldn't be a bad place to have a nice 90-100 square meter pied-à-terre?
Well, I think the fascinating thing is, you know, that the economy there is still very affordable for anybody considering doing something new. So I was speaking to a former colleague who's running a company down there that now, and she was talking about actually hiring studio space and just saying, is it just a matter of a few euros to get it for the hour? And there are so many skilled people there, even now, still working freelance, still looking for opportunities. So I think there's lots of people who have found their moment to kind of reignite something. And yeah, some of the apartments in downtown Athens are just extraordinary.
Now, the mayor is being a bit of a diplomat. We see a lot of main Mediterranean centers, Eastern Mediterranean centers, certainly in flux at the moment. We know Istanbul has its challenges, obviously very unfortunate, a city which is very close to us. Beirut, of course, even, of course, pre-blast was having its troubles. And then it has a lot of question marks. There was a lot of people talking about Cyprus, but, you know, is Cyprus really going to come good? Do you think there's an opportunity for Athens, you know, if of course, the right connections, and we know the right connections are going to come back, could Athens reestablish itself, do you think, as, you know, a bit of a jumping off point even to the Middle East?
Well, it's certainly got all the connections you need for travel, which is super important. As I said, you know, a very talented workforce. You know, Cyprus is interesting, but as many people have used it for offshoring money. That isn't the sense that you get in Athens as a city of industry and of trade. And you just look when that plane takes off even now and you fly over the port, you off over Piraeus, and just see all the ships waiting to come in. You know how much business is going on there. But, you know, tough moments as well. You know, there's a standoff with Turkey about gas riots in the Mediterranean. We saw over the weekend questions about refugees in Greece. So Greece still needs help from the outside world, and there's lots of things to mediate, but the city of Athens itself feels really kind of poised for a good moment.
Great. Andrew Tuck, our editor there. That's all for today's edition of The Briefing. The show is produced by Marcus Hippie and Julian Goff, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back at the very same time tomorrow. I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a great day.